Hello, beloved On Being listeners and friends. Many of you are asking how you can help support the work we're doing at the On Being Project. If we're fortunate enough to make it onto your list for giving this year, you can absolutely visit onbeing.org/give. Your generosity of every kind is gratefully received. Thank you for being with us on this adventure.
On Being is brought to you by the John Templeton Foundation. The Templeton Foundation supports academic research and civil dialogue on the deepest, most perplexing questions facing humankind. Who are we? Why are we here? And where are we going? To learn more, please visit templeton.org. The Templeton Foundation. Stay curious.
The work of healing has not had much of a place in the complex of reckonings in the past year that we condense into the hashtag MeToo. But surely what we are naming and wrapping our arms around with the impetus of MeToo is at best an opening to a long-term cultural reckoning to grow up humanity, to make our society more whole. I walked with some trepidation onto this territory at the invitation of the Solutions Journalism Network, together with feminist journalist Rebecca Traister and psychotherapist Avi Klein, who works primarily with men and couples. In a room full of journalists, we explored how they and all the rest of us might build the spaces, the imaginative muscle, and the pragmatic forms to support healing for women and men where it is possible, now and in time.
One of the reasons that it's very rare for women to coalesce in a women's movement in which that anger is about gendered inequality is that if you're going to look straight at and sort of acknowledge the inequalities on the table, what that means is disturbing some of the most intimate relationships in our lives. So it's partners and lovers and spouses, fathers and brothers and sons, and it's profoundly emotionally difficult to do that kind of assessment of unequal power within our most daily, intimate, emotionally tight relationships.
When we've hurt someone, or we just don't really want to take it in all of the way, and in part it's because it makes us feel so bad about ourselves, right? And you need to, there's a steadying that people need in those moments. I think about how I would try to help someone open themselves up. This isn't about you right now, this is about her, right? What it takes to feel solid enough to hear that, that's where I go.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. The phrase Me Too was coined over a decade ago by civil rights activist Tarana Burke. Rebecca Traister has chronicled this lineage and has been a force in our current grapplings as a writer for New York Magazine and with her book, Good and Mad. I first became aware of Avi Klein through an illuminating piece he wrote in the New York Times in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein revelations about how that was changing what men were bringing into therapy. We gathered at the City College of New York. We are all here as human beings, all of us, up here and out there, as human beings as well as professional people, and I think it's important, especially around this, to be transparent about that. So I wanted to start, and I'll start with you, Rebecca, to just say something about the background of your life and experience that your conscience has shaped your response to and your engagement with this moment.
Well, there's the fact that I have, at some point in my mid to late 20s, I became a feminist journalist. And I've often wondered, I grew up in an era, white middle-class woman who was born in a family with generally left politics, but in a Reagan era, super anti-feminist backlash period. I could no more have conceived of the idea that I would someday be a feminist journalist than I could have flown when I was in high school or college, or frankly, you know, several years beyond college, even when I was first a journalist. But there was something always in my background and my life that drew me to questions around inequality. I remember watching the Anita Hill hearings, as many people my age, younger, and certainly older do. I actually watched them, her testimony, with my extremely conservative Republican grandparents in rural Maine who thought she was lying. And I remember sitting there in this little kitchen on the farm where my mom grew up,
watching the little black and white TV and thinking very quietly in my own head, I don't think she's lying. I don't think she's lying. And I don't know like what knit together, but it did. And so then for the past 15 years, it's been a process of both being a feminist journalist and also trying to learn the history that in many ways I was never taught as a young person.
What year were you born?
So I'm just 75.
75, yeah. Okay. And so a theme, if not the theme that's emerged through your grappling with this, has been women's anger and the unhealthy relationship women have had to anger and the importance of reclaiming that healthy relationship. Is that, would you say it that way?
Yeah, I would say that, I'm trying to think about how health plays into it.
Yeah.
I think that, no, that's a real question for me and
part
of the stuff that
I think the way I'm saying that is kind of clinical.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it boils down to, but it's a lot more colorful than that, like the actual experience. I mean, I guess this is what I mean when I say what you're talking about is getting healthy relationship to anger. So this is something you wrote. What is good for us is opening our mouths and letting it out, permitting ourselves to feel it and say it and think it and act on it and integrate it into our lives, just as we integrate joy and sadness and worry and optimism.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would be a healthy relationship. You're the psychotherapist.
Sounds healthy to me.
So let me ask you this. You've been out on book tour. You've been out there talking about this all over the place. What questions do you find people are emerging now? What's surfacing that we still need to work with that you're holding that other people are holding?
I think that one of the most both gratifying and saddening things that I'm finding is the absolute starvation for the yearning for acknowledgement that women who are feeling this way aren't alone. And that's one of the things that I write about, to feel like their angers, their frustrations, their fears are not them alone, that they're not all the things that we get the message that we are if we're angry and scared and frustrated, which is they're not crazy, they're not the only one that's feeling this way, and that in fact there are people they might connect to that can better put in context what they're feeling in both a historical and a political way. So there's been that, and I don't think I was emotionally or intellectually prepared for the intensity of that desire, but it's like I can feel it every time I speak to a group, that kind of like, oh my God, the sort of electricity and weight of connection and feeling like you're part of a bigger story, both nationally now or historically in the broader context. And then the questions tend to be both about how, if there is a movement that this anger is bringing many people into. A lot of the questions are about how can we make this movement better than it has been in earlier iterations?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a prescriptive book to begin with, but to the degree that it does recommend a course of action, it's not about individual expression. For one thing, I think women are filled with 14 billion different messages about what they're supposed to do or not do with their anger or how they're supposed to voice it or not voice it. And me telling people go out and rage isn't going to do anybody any good. So, to the degree that I have any prescriptive recommendation, it's not about expression of anger, it's about listening to the anger of the people around you, including anger that may be directed in part at you. It's about finding connection through listening, not necessarily through a different mode of expression. And I'm struck, so I wind up saying that a lot when people ask, like, what do we do? What do we do? How do we make it better? How do we do it differently? And very often my answer comes down to listen to the people around you, be curious about what they're angry about. And then when you ask, when you seek out their answers, listen to them, take them on, consider them, give them political weight, give them intellectual weight. Imagine that the anger around you is a valid anger as your anger is. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, I think we're not told that very often.
I think that really leads, is a nice segue, Avi, into the angle you've had on all of this. And it feels to me also like this question I asked Rebecca about what in your life and experience you are aware you bring to engaging with this moment, that has come together for you in your work.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you said, you wrote, the Me Too era has changed my work.
Yeah. I think in a very particular way, because to make an unfair generalization, but for one of the differences in working with men than with women is women have spent a lot more time looking at themselves internally and talking about what's happening with their friends, and they have the vocabulary for it. And men sometimes don't. And so this moment has done them a favor in that way, in forcing them, in bringing up uncomfortable feelings that they were usually more, they're better equipped to ignore and avoid. So that, I think that's been the most palpable change, is just sort of forced its
way in. And I mean, you mentioned many reactions you've had to this. You said you've had the curious experience of tracking my own occasional defensiveness at female rage and wrestling with uncomfortable self-reflection.
Yeah, I was, I think about that a lot, and was thinking about it when I was listening to Rebecca speak, that I don't think I'm alone in when someone is angry, and maybe you personalize it, maybe it's not even directed at you, but it feels personal, there is this instinctive, you know, impulse to pull away, and I don't want to hear it, let me reject that. Mm-hmm. And it is just sort of the question, what if you didn't do that? What if you just stayed and opened yourself up to it? What would happen?
And you describe men coming in and, I mean, you have said that you, at least in this piece, and I'd be curious if you think this has changed, but you've been discouraged by what you feel is a muted public reflection among men.
Yeah.
And yet you've really been privy to private self-searching and men coming into therapy and saying, you know, raking over. And I've also had this conversation with male friends, like really just going back over their lives and asking, like, not, and you know, some of it is there something that's going to come back to bite me?
Right.
I mean, there's that, but there's also just a lot of like, you know, what did I hurt people without meaning to hurt people? Mm-hmm. And I mean, you've said, you know, men have said to you, am I a monster? You know, am I like Harvey Weinstein?
Yeah. And I do, anecdotally, it seems like it is starting to change. There was a man who wrote an op-ed recently in the Washington Post about witnessing a rape 40 years ago. And there's another thing in the New York Times recently where men are being more vocal, and I'm so heartened by that and admire the courage. But yeah, I think there is something about these private spaces. I think it sort of needs to happen that way at first, because you're opening yourself up to potentially a lot of anger and a lot of regret.
And you know, when Tarana Burke was interviewed this week, she actually mentioned that, you know, just the way we do things now, it's all in public, right? It's tweeted, and that's how it feels like you have impact. But there's a lot of this work that probably has to happen in private to be fruitful and to be healing, honestly.
Yeah.
I feel like that's something we need to wrestle with.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that, and that it feels right to
me. I mean, for men and women, for victims and perpetrators.
It's messy, right? It's really messy to find your way. Where do you want to land on something? How do you really feel about it? And it's complicated. And if you just say the first thing that's on your mind, that may not be what you ultimately think about it or how you feel about it. That's been my experience with the men I work with.
Did you want to say something?
Well, one of the things that I have learned, you know, writing my book about women's anger, it's women's anger in all kinds of contexts. Women who are angry about workplace inequality, you know, help launch a labor movement. Women angry about racial inequality and injustice, the civil rights movement, women in the gay rights movement. Something that's very particular about gendered inequality in this country is sort of a structural reality, which is that every woman has men in her life, and every man has women in their life.
And some of us are raising sons.
Yes. But what that means, one of the reasons that it's very rare for women to coalesce in a women's movement in which that anger is about gendered inequality, and that happens sort of only maybe every 60 years or so, is because one of the incredibly difficult structural realities of that is that if you're going to look straight at and sort of acknowledge the inequalities on the table, what that means is disturbing some of the most intimate relationships in our lives. So it's partners and lovers and spouses for hetero people. It's fathers and brothers and sons and friends and neighbors and coworkers. And that means sort of
permitting your, because a lot of this stuff is about permitting yourself to feel the anger, to note where there is inequality or where you have been treated badly, often by someone you love, or where you have treated someone badly, often someone you love. And it's profoundly emotionally difficult mm-hmm. to do that kind of assessment of unequal power within our most daily, intimate, emotionally tight relationships. It is a real structural obstacle to getting mass women's movements. And when you do, it's one of the reasons that you have rupture in some of these. You see divorces go up. You right. see relationships fall apart. You see, you know, the stuff of furious Thanksgiving dinners and, you know, broken hearts.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, exploring Me Too through a solutions lens with journalist Rebecca Traister and psychotherapist Avi Klein. One thing that I've been thinking about so much in these last weeks also is that the spaces, you know, I really don't want this to be about the Kavanaugh hearings because, you know, that was a moment, potentially a very historically significant moment, but it was a moment. And it awakened, it inflamed all of this that was already with us. And I felt like it, as a canvas for that, as a place for people to project this real trauma, it wasn't worthy of that. It was so flawed as a lens on all of that. So if our private places is hard and our public place, I mean, again, this may just be a question we put into the room. Like, how do we honor the private nature of this and find and create those spaces that can be worthy of how intimate this is and how important?
Yeah, I guess I think about my own experience and my own work, and I'm thinking about men that I've worked with who have taken something out of our work together and then brought it into progressively more public spaces, into their relationships, but then how much work went into being prepared for that, working through their relationships with themselves first, and that it starts so small before you can get to a place where you can, because even to open up about these things is so potentially, it's destructive, it's opening yourself up to shame and humiliation and anger, and it takes a lot to say, that's what I need to do right now. Our relationship, the integrity of our relationship needs that.
I want to ask you about something you wrote. I want to ask you to explain this. Yeah. Shame is the emotional weapon that allows patriarchal behaviors to flourish.
Yeah. I guess what I was trying to say there is that, and I would imagine there are other people who could say this more eloquently than I can, but there's a sense that I have with men working through some of the behaviors that they've engaged in and some of the attitudes that they've had, where the shame that they're really feeling, sadly, it's not about how they're treating women, it's about how they appear in the eyes of other men. So much of it is motivated by that, about saving face in front of your peers, your friends, your father. There's someone, you know, one of the quotes of someone I worked with who in that piece talks about having a notch in his belt when he thinks about his like serial cheating on his partners. And it's like, that's really about what his friends think of him. It's not about impressing women. And in that way, I think that there's this shame of not being a man it's about where you stand in patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. That just made me think, so in a way that I hadn't so palpably, and not to return to the Kavanaugh hearings, but about the places where Kavanaugh, in his public rage, which he was able to wield as a weapon on his behalf, where he broke down and wept. In part, it was like his dad and the calendars, right? That I hadn't thought of it that way, but what you just said made me realize that some of it, mm-hmm. some of the apparent grief he felt, or perhaps shame, if there was shame, was about how his public, not necessarily about whether or not he may have done harm to Christine right. Blasey Ford or Deborah Ramirez, or, but rather that
that this was about his standing. And again, of course, we've seen that amplified by those around him, this notion that he was attacked, that, you know, that the person who'd been injured here was, in fact, the powerful accused man. But listening to you talk, I just remembered his voice breaking specifically about his dad and the calendars, and he always kept a calendar. And it was like, oh, God, right, that's part of what that's about.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, you also said that men who you're working with have this deep fear that, in fact, they are boys,
yeah.
That they're not men, that somehow that's something always that they feel that they have to be proving.
Yeah, that's something that men volunteer really early on, actually, when they sit down with me. I don't feel like I'm a man. I feel like I'm still a boy. That there's this sense that they don't. It's so. I think it would be so surprising for other people to hear that these. I work mostly with affluent white men, and they feel like they don't have agency in their personal lives. They don't. They feel like there's a sense in which whatever they're engaged in, that they're not really in charge of that in some way, and it's confusing mm-hmm. to them.
Mm-hmm. So, something. The New York Times Sunday Review had this piece on the front page, and 1 year on, which was not that long ago, from the Harvey Weinstein story. And, you know, the last line of the article was, "Progress requires a correct accounting of what women have faced." And I read that and I think, yes, and progress requires so much more than an accounting. And I think that is a conversation to be had in a room full of journalists. Because I do think that journalism, and I started out as a print reporter, has best trained people to do that kind of accounting, especially of damage, right, and of corruption. And I guess, you know, one thing that's on my mind is, again, that, you know, we've been talking about men's shame. This question of creating worthy spaces and forms for women's trauma and anger to be out in public, and I don't even like the word safe. I feel like the word safe has been kind of ruined, but trustworthy spaces for that. And I think that's also a bit perilous in journalism because of the impulse to shine a light on the damage.
I think that what you're saying ties into some of the conflicting feelings that I've had about the role that journalists played in the hashtag MeToo mm-hmm. movement. You know, the version of MeToo, 11 years after Tarana Burke's Me Too movement that began with the reporting on Harvey Weinstein on October 5th. And this is a real case of conflicting emotions within my own head, because on the one hand, the story of Harvey, right, this individual man, somehow captured an imagination and captured the attention in a way that then became tactically useful moving forward, sort of created the space, even in the fast-moving media world of a Trump administration, created the space and in which so many other stories could pour forth. And I think that, and that for me is the part that it's the women's stories and men's stories, that were the part that I was the most invested in, like a full picture of lived experience in the world, including experiences that had remained silent and untold for so long, but that had perhaps had profound impact on people's lives, careers, trajectories, and yet the full story of their lives, careers, trajectories could never be told because this was an unspeakable thing. And that happened because there was reporting on individual men. Simultaneously, I remain so frustrated by the fact that the reporting was on these individual men, because I think that supported this belief that, you know, that it was individual monsters mm-hmm. and not the whole system mm-hmm. that is rigged. And that in itself permitted a whole bunch of misperceptions about what the value of what we were learning was, because A, training the attention on these individual men, you know, supported this idea, oh, if we just get rid of these few bad apples, we'll solve the problem, which of course we know is not true. The problem is an unequal distribution of power and the behavior of those who wield an excess of it. But also, it re-diverted all the attention to the men so that
without suggesting that we shouldn't be thinking, obviously we should be thinking about how men's participation in this, because the stories became these individual powerful men, A, it blotted out the value of other stories where there wasn't a movie star or a politician,
right?
Right? So that the Ford factory employees who told their stories to the New York Times, the airline workers, flight attendants, hotel workers being reported on by the Huffington Post, the McDonald's workers who 2 weeks ago went out on strike in response to pervasive sexual harassment at their institution, they're just not getting the same attention because there's not a Harvey Weinstein or an Eric Schneiderman who is a character or a person who, in part because of their outsized power, is familiar to us and thus who we can sympathize with as a human story that draws our eye.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the often nameless or unknown to us, you know, few women, dozens of women, hundreds of women, and some men who have made allegations against this powerful figure, their stories and the harm, even though it's their stories that propelled the revelation about this powerful man, they're not given the same imaginative weight in the media as what happens to the man who's accused.
Not only that, we get that story in thousands and thousands and thousands of words with all the salacious details, and it has that awful way that true crime is riveting, you know?
Yeah.
In a terrible way, it becomes, you know, perversely entertaining.
Right. But I'm really torn on this because I also understand that to the degree that we were able to have this conversation, I mean, all these things that are simultaneously bad about the way this unfolded, the fact that it was only something that a mass number of people could focus on when it was white, wealthy movie stars.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is, we have to look instead of the fabric of our culture. But that is also the very thing that enabled it to become a force that freed so many tongues. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And so these things, it's the way I also feel about repercussions, frankly. Mm-hmm. I am not a big repercussion person. Mm-hmm. I am not a big, like, I don't want to be anybody's police. I don't want to be anybody's judge. I feel very ambivalent and unsure about, you know, even stating ideas about what repercussions should entail for any particular offense. At the same time, I have to recognize that if there weren't repercussions, the behavior would never change. I mean, all these things can be true simultaneously and push directly back and forth against each other as we're trying to wrestle with them and figure out how to make this work better.
Mm-hmm. What are you thinking, Avi?
Well, right now I was just appreciating Rebecca's ability to articulate things that oppose each other like that. Mm. So that's what I was really thinking right now. I'm sort of hesitant to weigh in some ways because the work I do is so the opposite, is so on a smaller scale and private. So where I was going in my mind was about what happens, like when I work with a couple, for example, and a partner, let's say the male partner, has really hurt his wife, right, in an emotional way. And the resistance to really taking in that hurt. It's an interesting thing to watch people. We do it all the time. We all do it, right? And I think that's what this is sort of speaking
when
to.
When we've hurt someone?
When we've hurt someone, or we just don't really want to take it in all of the way. And in part, it's because it makes us feel so bad about ourselves, right? And you need to, there's a steadying that people need in those moments. I think about how I would try to help someone open themselves up. This isn't about you right now. This is about her, right? What it takes to feel solid enough to hear that. That's where I go.
A short break, more with Avi Klein and Rebecca Traister. And if you haven't visited our podcast feed lately, check out all the new occasional and bite-sized extras. In the latest installment of Living the Questions, I take up a question from our community about what civility actually means and whether it can be enough in a time like ours. This and more wherever podcasts are found.
Support for On Being with Krista Tippett comes from the Fetzer Institute, helping build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer envisions a world that embraces love as a guiding principle and animating force for our lives, a powerful love that helps us live in sacred relationship with ourselves, others, and the natural world. Learn more by visiting Fetzer.org.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being. Today, exploring Me Too through a solutions lens, the generative work we might begin to map out inside ourselves and in our life together, alongside the mapping of devastation and the honoring of the depths of trauma in our midst. We're at the City College of New York at the invitation of the Solutions Journalism Network. I'm speaking with Avi Klein, a psychotherapist who works primarily with men and couples, and feminist journalist Rebecca Traister.
So, you know, my personal, I was born in 1960. So in the previous generation for you, like right in the wake of that monumental women's movement, of course, we're generalizing like crazy here. So I was the first generation of women who got the message that you can do anything. Being a woman isn't a problem. A woman like me, with the particular education I had and all of that, you can do it all. You can do it all. You can have it all. And I proceeded in that spirit, and it turns out not to be true. There was no template for how you do all these things, how you work and be in a relationship and parent and just be healthy. And everybody felt like everybody else was getting it better than they were. But one of the things I was really clear on, I think women in my generation were clear of, is one of the things those founders did is they didn't bring men along with them. And so we were enlightened. We had changed. We were different from our mothers, but the men in our lives weren't different from our fathers. And so, you know, it's very complicated because on the one hand, we want to say it's trauma of, and it's not only women, but sexual assault, and it is mostly women, that must be at the forefront of our attention and our care. And sometimes when you want to raise it, like, what do we do with men? Like, how do we move forward with men? That can feel almost like an affront. And I do think what, you know, the move Rebecca was making a minute ago is we have to be doing a bunch of different things at once. Culturally, we're not so comfortable with that, right? We're all purists these days.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, you know, sometimes there's just a natural instinct for so many of us to take ourselves out of conflict. And I'm thinking about some of the men that I've worked with where they would, they just use language in tricky ways, right? Unintentionally, but they obscure what they're talking about.
Right.
So be like, you know, that thing that she's upset at me about, like, oh, when you cheated on her, right? right? but I can't say that, right? If I said that, they'd leave. That's just how I'm feeling in the moment. But so what do you do? How do you let someone just sit in their own denial, right? They're reinforcing it themselves. And so another therapist who I admire a lot taught me a way of doing that, which is, right, the reason I can't say that is because then I would be sacrificing our relationship to tell this person the truth, right? He would just leave. So I put that on the table. I say, I really care about our relationship, so tell me, can I push back on something right now, or is that too much for you? And I let them decide, can they hear it or not? And then once they hear it, then I tell them, I think when I hear you say something like that, I think you're obscuring what really happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that, can we look at that together? And then afterwards, I say, I'm appreciating that we have a relationship that's based in honesty, just to start to shift what's happening here.
Mm-hmm. I'm bizarrely, for a, you know, big old man-hating, angry woman, like, I'm very
you're the one who told the world that you have a better sex life when you're angry.
Yeah.
It's in the book.
No, it's healthy. If you let your anger out, you're a healthier person. So one of the things you asked about being on tour, and one of the things that's been brought to my attention over the past 3 weeks is the degree to which I am so man-friendly, right? And I have been a very unapologetic and hypercritical voice for a long time when it comes to the patriarchal abuses of power. But I have been thinking, and people have brought up to me recently, I go and I talk to rooms full of people, and I find myself happy to see every man in that room. And then on a couple of occasions afterwards, I've been talking to people after, and some of the other people there have been like, oh, the guys asked all the questions. And I'm like, oh, I was so happy they were participating I say that to say that perhaps I err on the side, ironically, of generosity toward men and their interest in participating more than some of my contemporaries and peers would. But that said, I do believe that big wave did change generations of men. Not completely, because I think that this is a process that takes centuries, right?
Yeah.
I think that the hopes of that generation that, like, you know, things were going to be fixed, I think that we're all guilty of thinking that in a moment of eruptive fury and propellant change, we're going to fix all the problems. And our history in this country tells us that these, even the individual movements that we think of in retrospect as being kind of neat, like, remember the civil rights movement?
Yeah.
That was decades, right? Like, I think that one of the difficult things about this moment that was also difficult during that second wave period is we're asking the world, we're suggesting that we're changing the rules of a game that most people are well into, halfway through, mm-hmm. right? This is a really tricky ask. And the way we can think of it in the second wave is that we had a generation of people who had entered marriages, and especially sort of white middle-class marriages built around post-war investments by our government in creating a sort of idyllic white middle class. And those marriages had been entered into willingly and enthusiastically by men and women who expected marriage to entail a certain breakdown of responsibility, right? And both the men and women had gone into them eagerly, right? And then along came a social movement that exploded expectations.
Well, the women were taking Valium, though. I mean,
many of them were. Deep into those relationships, yeah. Many of the women were taking Valium, in part because, of course, they were premised on a fundamental inequality and unjust organization of power. And so then came a social and political movement that exploded those expectations, that opened new doors, not just economically and professionally and educationally, but sexually. And suddenly, in the midst of some of those marriages, the rules and possibilities changed. And you found people, including men, who were like, wait, we did this together, and now you're telling me that I'm an abuser of a kind of power, or that I'm a patriarch, or that my behavior has been unacceptable, but in fact it was perfectly right. We're doing a version of that now, where we're changing the rules. We're trying to change the rules with the understanding that those rules have been set up and our norms have been set up in ways that are fundamentally unjust to vast swaths of people. And so we want to change them. But changing the mid-game means that some people who've been playing by them are going to be caught out at having violated rules they were born thinking they could play by.
Well, and not only we're changing the rules by which the people who are right now at the peak of their power and leading our institutions were masters,
mm-hmm.
okay? It's like what we're talking about is the pace of human change, which is not only slower than we want it to be, but it's always uneven.
Right.
There are people who get there first,
right.
And there are people who take a long time, even for things that later just look so obvious. I think one thing I want to get to, which really flows out of this, is the question of, I don't really want to just say a space for apology and redemption. I want to say a space for change, right? I was listening back to a conversation I had with Desmond Tutu years ago, and he was talking about what happened in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and how they did create this, they created a trustworthy, an honored space for stories to be told. And then he talked about how when in a setting like that where the stories were held, the people were held, spontaneously, the people who had harmed them, I mean, sometimes grievously, right, murdered their families, had to listen. But creating the right setting for that, spontaneously, they asked for forgiveness. And then something new, you know, it wasn't, like he says, a moment of reconciliation is something that then takes generations, but there can be this moment of forgiveness that is the beginning of a lot of new possibility. So I think, how do we talk about redemption, or I don't want to say forgiveness, right? Just change, growth, and how, because it's not actually safe now, because we don't really reward people in general, but in this, for saying, boy, I was really wrong.
Yeah, I'm thinking about what it typically takes someone, like to create a space where you can be open and vulnerable in that way, and the amount, typically, right, people need to feel pretty safe, and you have to have a lot of trust. And it's important to remember how hard that is to just create that. Even one-on-one with people, the amount of safety and trust before we ever, I mean, the people that I wrote about, by the way, you know, it took them, oftentimes it was months. They'd say they were coming in for one thing, and we'd do that for a little while, and then they would share what was really on their minds because they didn't know me, and they didn't know what it would be like. And that's just with one other person who is supposed to be non-judgmental, right? So what it takes to open yourself up and not know what you're going to get back, it does take bravery, it does take courage. It's important to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, I think in my mind, I think more about, maybe it's because of who I work with, but I think more about the apology than the forgiveness, right? That if you really...
The asking for forgiveness.
But that it's almost like, I guess, without any incentive to be forgiven.
Yeah.
Because that's what you need, right? The person who's wronged. But what is the person who you've wronged? What do they need to hear?
Yeah.
And they need, I think, one, they need to know that you hold them in your heart, that you hold their experience in your heart. What you did to them, you're allowing yourself to imagine it, what it was like for them, I think is so important. And then once you've let yourself imagine that, what did that do to you?
Yeah. So I feel, Rebecca, that that's the journalism, we need to develop almost a new muscle.
Well, it would also have to better control for its own self-made audiences, because in part, you know, I think about... again, my interest is in the stories of the women, or the mostly women, who are explaining and telling the stories of their lives fully, often for the first time. But that can't bridge that divide that Avi's describing, because if those stories aren't actually being heard by the people who've inflicted some of that pain, then it does give comfort to others, right? It provides some of that connection and network building amongst people who've shared those experiences and derive something of value from hearing those stories. But it doesn't accomplish that thing that I agree with Avi is the key to moving forward, whatever form that takes. And I, again, like, I'm very wary about, you know, making any pronouncements about who needs to do what in order to gain this forgiveness. But I do think that I completely agree that the crucial part of the process is it being in part about the stories of those who've been hurt, and them being able to communicate one way or another to the people who hurt them, this is what it was like. And so much of what we hear from the men reflects a kind of lack of curiosity,
yeah,
mm-hmm, about what the experience of having been harmed in some way actually entailed, because it might not be the things that they're imaginatively guessing at and performing.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out how to do that within journalism is very difficult, because you can't force people to read or listen to things they don't want to read or listen to.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I have been heartened, and what Avi's saying about his practice heartens me, that even if it's not the big like the Louis C.K.'s of the world who are doing the listening, I do believe that there are a lot of men out there who are reading these stories, who are having their eyes and ears open. They're men in my life. They're my friends. I hear from them in many ways that bizarrely resemble the way that you're hearing from them, even though I wouldn't think that they'd come to me,
mm-hmm,
for that. But
mm-hmm,
but doing an accounting, you know, what have I done? This is what I've done. And maybe they're looking to me for forgiveness, but I know that they're doing some work on this.
Yeah. Just in the last few minutes, are there other questions or observations that you'd want to just surface, either one of you?
I was just thinking about, as I was listening to you, about like why don't we want to listen? You know, like why do we push against it? And particularly men. And I think for one, so if you really take in the reality of the hurt that the pain that women are going through, one that just that feels really bad, and it's really hard to open yourself up to that. And then there's this way in which I think men are so often used to trying to fix things, and there's a real helplessness that they feel in hearing this without having to do anything else but listen. And there isn't a lot of it just needs to be said so many times. All you need to do is listen. You just have to listen.
Well, listen and act and perhaps change your behavior. The analogous thing for me that I think about sort of constantly right now is writing about racism within a feminist movement and how hard it is for white women to sort of do the same process of listening to why women of color within their progressive movement are angry at them, us, me, white feminist, for having benefited from the kinds, you know, and participated in, you know, a system of inequality. And so I think about that from a white feminist perspective and how difficult it is for progressive white women to take on board the knowledge that they have participated in and benefited from, you know, a kind of inequality that they imagine themselves dead set against. We want to be the heroes of our lives, right? Mm. And I think that being told that, I mean, and I think this may be true specifically within progressive political circles where we imagine ourselves fighting injustice and being good people, having that vision of ourselves disturbed by the actual fury of those who don't view us as the heroes, but in fact, to whom we have done harm in one way or another, I think it's a hard thing to acknowledge.
Yeah.
You know, the imperfection of your own, what you view as your purpose.
And this is not for 2 minutes, but women, some of us have those rules of the game we all played by. Right? And I'm not talking about where rape was at hand.
Right.
But we're all relearning the rules. And some of us very successfully maneuvered our way through that to our advantage. And this is a discussion women are going to have among themselves.
And that's one of the things that I think was initially read as a generational split over Me Too, and I don't think the generational explanation fully covers it.
Right.
But I do think that there is a reality for many women who were groundbreakers in many regards and were angry and did furious work of participating in social and political disruption, but also did that disrupting within a system within which they also existed and in many cases flourished. And then to have another wave of disruptive fury come and interrogate that system in which they themselves have flourished, it feels like an attack on them. And again, the failure to acknowledge the way that they themselves had been disruptors and had been fighting on the side of good. And that's one of the hardest dynamics. I know so many women who for years, as I've been writing about feminism, women who said to me, why aren't young women angry? Why aren't young women angry? And then young women got angry. And often it was those part of who they were angry about were some of the older women.
Well, I feel that we did put a lot out in the room that's really valuable. And we were never going to solve it today. But I think there's a lot of good fodder and raw material here for even the H word, for healing, for solutions. I actually thought it would be good to let Tarana Burke have the last word in the room. You know, her point is a lot of things are getting conflated. And she said, you know, Me Too at its heart, well, she said, there is in Me Too a particular problem to be solved among all the even broader ones. Millions of people around the world who are survivors of sexual violence, very specifically sexual violence, raise their hands to say, Me Too, and their hands are still raised. Mm-hmm. Thank you for having us.
Rebecca Traister is a writer for New York Magazine and a contributing editor at Elle.
Her books include Big Girls Don't Cry, All the Single Ladies, and Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Avi Klein is a psychotherapist and licensed clinical social worker. He practices in Manhattan. His 2018 New York Times op-ed piece was titled, What Men Say About Me Too in Therapy. On Being is
Chris Heagle,
Lily Percy,
Mariah Helgeson,
Maya Tarrell,
Marie Sambalay,
Aaron Farrell,
Lauren Dordal,
Tony Liu,
Bethany Iverson,
Aaron Colasacco,
Kristen Lin,
Prophet Adewu,
Caspatech Kyle,
Angie Thurston,
Sue Phillips,
Eddie Gonzalez,
Lillian Vo,
Lucas Johnson,
Damon Lee,
Suzette Burley,
Katie Gordon,
and Zach Rose.
Special thanks this week to Courtney Martin, Sarah Morrison, Carlos Fonseca, David Bornstein, and the important work of the Solutions Journalism Network. Our lovely theme music is provided and composed by Zoe Keating. And the last voice you hear singing our final credits in each show is hip-hop artist Lizzo. On Being was created at American Public Media. Our funding partners include the George Family Foundation, in support of the Civil Conversations Project, the Fetzer Institute, helping to build the spiritual foundation for a loving world. Find them at fetzer.org. Calliopeia Foundation, working to create a future where universal spiritual values form the foundation of how we care for our common home. Humanity United, advancing human dignity at home and around the world. Find out more at humanityunited.org, part of the Omidyar Group. The Henry Luce Foundation, in support of public theology reimagined. The Osprey Foundation, a catalyst for empowered, healthy, and fulfilled lives. And the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interests in religion, community development, and education.
On Being is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and is a Krista Tippett public production.